Real World Entrepreneurship Podcast with Bhairav Patel and Alan Clark.
Welcome to the Real World Entrepreneurship Podcast, where we tackle the practical challenges that startup founders and small business owners face and give our own unvarnished opinions. My name is Bhairav Patel. I'm the Managing Director at Atom Ventures and Atom CTO, where we partner with small businesses and startup founders to help them define and build their tech vision.
And I'm Alan Clark. I'm the founder of the Business Growth Partnership, and we work with high-potential businesses to help them unblock the blockages that are preventing them from reaching their full potential.
Well, today we're joined by Mark Drager. Mark is a YouTuber and business founder. He never went to university. He didn't go to film school. He created a production company, once it grew to a multi-million dollar turnover, and then, in his own words, watched it all crumble around him, and has now regrown it. He describes himself as a brand strategist and believes that you need courage to be an entrepreneur and a business founder. And that's where I'd like to start. Hi, Mark, welcome along. But let's begin with, aren't all entrepreneurs fundamentally courageous? Isn't this just a requirement of anyone that starts up a business?
That's a great question. And Alan and Bhairav, thank you for having me. Are we courageous as entrepreneurs? No. In my experience, entrepreneurs are not risk takers. We are not courageous to start with. We are foolish. We foolishly believe we can do it better. We foolishly believe that we can make more money, or that we have a better system or a better plan, or we connect dots that others don't connect. And so are we naturally courageous? I think others see us as having courage. I think they see us as being risk takers. But honestly, it's the excitement, it's the idea, it's the foolishness that gets us into it. And then when we realize, oh my goodness, this is so much harder than I thought. I didn't think it would take this long. I didn't think it would be this much work. I didn't think that I would have to do all of these things myself year after year or whatever it might be. At that point, we have so much sunken cost. We have so much that we've put into it. We can't possibly walk away, but we've learned a lot and we've grown a lot, and we naturally become more courageous and we naturally get more comfortable with risk. But to start out with, in my experience, I don't think we're that courageous.
But then don't you think so a lot of people that, you know, I work with are people who have got a nice stable job, right? So they may be working in a nice big firm and they got a nice big fat paycheck and maybe a decent pension at the end of it. And for them to kind of give that up and then move into the world of entrepreneurship where you're not quite sure whether you'll succeed and maybe you're going to spend all your life savings for an idea that may never work. Isn't there an element of courage in that?
Oh, I think so. If we wanted to romanticize it, of course, you know, like, listen, I'm all about courage because I admire the courage that one has to be able to commit to an idea, to be able to work hard, to be able to go after it. I'm at my youngest daughter's in dance. She's in competitive dance. And as I watch these 11 and 12 year olds take the stage, I'm sitting in the audience crying because they have the courage to step on the stage and to do things that frankly would embarrass the heck out of me. I would never imagine myself being able to do what they do. So I see courage in that. I see courage in anyone who has the conviction and the belief to be able to go out and do something that others will not do. But I don't think courage is the number one driver behind the person who's leaving the C-suite job or the senior manager job to go out and strike out on their own. I think it's excitement. I think it's, I'm at a point in my life where I'm going to do this. I'm going to take the risk. I'm going to take it on. I don't want to die with regrets. So I just, yeah, it's an interesting topic though.
I like the idea that you suggest that, I guess there's also a difference between second, third and fourth time entrepreneurs who maybe have learned rather a lot along the way and actually realize what they're letting themselves in for. But those first times entrepreneurs, I like this idea of they're foolish rather than courageous. And I guess, you know, I did my first really entrepreneurial thing in my 40s. And I had spent all the point up to that too scared to lose what I had. Mm-hmm. And by that point, I was able to section off a part and say, well, if I lose all of that, that's fine, because I've still got enough equity, so to speak, behind me to carry on. But that then leads me into thinking about, so you talk about this courageousness. What are those facets of courage that successful entrepreneurs develop? You know, what is it about being courageous that sets the winners out from the less successful?
Sorry, so the question is, what do the successful show in terms of courage
what are those elements of courageousness? Mm. What are those facets? You know, courage is a very broad term. You know, as you said, that could be foolish because I didn't know what I was doing. But what have you learned that allows you to be courageous?
So, there's a few things. Frankly, I've spent a lot of my life trying to be just as good as ... Right? When I started my business at 23, 2006, I wanted to be just as good as the other companies who had been in the market for a bunch of years. And then as we started to grow, I wanted to be just as good as the people who ran maybe larger agencies or were maybe VC backed. And when we did projects, I wanted our projects to be just as good as everyone else in the market. If we developed a new product, just as good, just as good, just as good. And what I came to realize over the years is if you spend a lot of time focusing on being just as good as everyone else, there's no reason for people to pick you. There's no reason for you to stand out. There's no reason for you to be different and to build a lasting business or a brand. And so the uncomfortable thing that takes courage is, in fact, being different. I've run a creative production and a branding company for 15 years. And I can't tell you the number of times where we would sit down with business owners, with marketers, with people in businesses from international brands, working with the NBA and working with huge, huge international companies to the smallest startup. And when we talk about what it is that they want to accomplish and do on paper, it's big dreams, it's big visions, it's bold statements. They want to do cool stuff. They want to make bold claims. They want to back it up with action. And then when it comes time to actually make something, they go, well, we can't say that. No, we couldn't possibly do that. So hold on. Let's go back. You want to have advertising. You want to make claims. You want to have a sales process that's just as big as, let's say, the old companies were always Apple, Tesla, like what have you, these big, bold companies that do these big, bold things. But then when it comes time for you to plant your flag in the ground, to make a statement, to stir things up, to take a stand, to say what only you can say because you have a unique position, you're not willing to do that? You want to go vanilla? You want to be the same as everyone else? You want to blend in? And then when we follow what they want, they go, how come it's not working? How come we're not standing out? How come nobody seems to care what we have to say? Listen, you need courage to be different. And so ultimately, what I so respect and so love, because I struggle with this myself, and I think most of us do, is we want to stand out in our way, in our comfort zone. We want to be different in our way, in our comfort zone. And we always, like, the classic these days is like, I'm talking to people about, I really want to grow my social following. I really want to grow my customer email list. Okay, are you on all the platforms? No, I won't go on TikTok. I'm not going to go on TikTok. Okay, I'm going to launch a podcast, but I'm not willing to do cut downs and to go onto YouTube and to go onto video. I'm only comfortable with audio. Okay, great. And so these efforts, these companies, our brands, are the courage it takes to do all of these things and to step out of our comfort zone. All of the efforts die from 1,000 little cuts because we always shrink everything down. So what I love about this topic is we need courage. We need to be courageous as business owners. If you're asking me, are we? No, we're not. Do we need to be? Yes, we do.
That's, and I think that's a very interesting nuance, right? Because I think, and you're right, I think a lot of times when you talk to people who've got big ideas, but the execution tends to be quite small, right? And quite conservative, because they don't want to risk losing money, or they don't want to risk losing, alienating investors or shareholders or whatever it is. But then, so I guess, how do you get over that, right? So it is a common problem. We do know that, you know, people, don't, I mean, one of the things I think I read on your, one of your website is, do what you're going to say you're going to do, right? And that is quite hard for a number of people. So how do you get over that? How do you actually, you know, break away from that, not necessarily anti-risk mindset, but how do you break out of that mindset, the conservative mindset, which I guess is what we're aiming for? I mean, how have you done it?
Well, I mean, this is something that I continue to struggle with. And I think, and the reason I'm so obsessed with it is because I tend to live in a place of doubt and fear, and I tend to live in a place of scarcity mindset. And I've spent the last number of years trying to pull myself out of that. So how do I do it? When I'm feeling my boldest version of myself, when I'm excited, I take some form of action that locks me in. So it might be 9 p.m. at night, right before bed. For whatever reason, I'm going like, oh, man, if I could just, cool, go downstairs to my office, open up my email, go to Instagram, send a DM, put the request in, say, I'm thinking about this idea, I'm making this happen, send the email to the team and say, hey guys, we're investing $25,000 in this action. And then the next day you wake up with the hangover of like, what did I just do? Right? It's like, oh no, what did I, but I don't want to be a liar. Now, is this the healthiest way for me to operate? I probably not. I mean, it's probably healthier for me to, you know, gracefully step into from action step to action step with peace and tranquility and all this stuff. But for me right now, what's more important is for me to build some momentum, for me to be able to, again, plant that flag to say, we are achieving this. 4 weeks ago, we're launching a brand new product right now that's making me uncomfortable. We're launching it in a way, and we're aiming to run this product and the operations in a way that I've not run in 15 years. I've never launched a product this way before. And 4 weeks ago, I said, in 8 weeks, sales are starting up. Now, outbound sales, inbound sales, marketing, affiliates, direct emails, we're exploring 7 different options. I don't know which one's going to work. But what's making me uncomfortable right now is I only got 4 weeks left. And I still don't know what's going to work. But when I was feeling bold a few weeks ago, when I was meeting with my team, I made the declaration. Do I want to be a liar? Do I want to be the person who just talks all the time and just says stuff, but then never figures it out? I don't want that to be me. So I make bold claims and I try to do really cool stuff and I try to back it up with action. Because by doing that, I'm setting a bar that I feel, I don't know about you, but I always rise to the occasion. This morning, perfect example, this morning, right? I'm in Canada. You guys are in the UK. You record at 10 a.m. your time, 5 a.m. my time. I had to be somewhere else. So I got up at 3:45 this morning. Last night, I'm laying in bed at 11 o'clock going, oh, I got to get up really, really early. I always rise to the occasion. But I don't put myself in a situation where I have to rise to the occasion often enough. I don't set that bar high enough that I have to live up to it, but I know I will. So that is part of what taking action and being able to break through this is about. It's about tapping into that bold version of you, raising that bar, and knowing when push comes to shove, you will rise to that occasion.
I'm interested in this idea of comfort zones that this really talks about. And what I think I'm hearing you saying is, if you're not shoving, pushing through the boundaries of your comfort zone, you're not really going anywhere.
I mean, is there another way to look at it? Do you guys believe something differently?
Well, I think, you know, I do my work in the UK, and often we talk about, well, do you know what, we're all very conservative and that British stereotype, which is why we don't push ourselves out there. And we reflect over to the North America, Canada and the US, and maybe they are different, fundamentally different. but with a view of how many times does that market, the entrepreneurs in that market say, oh, I better not do that. You know, that's getting a little bit wrong. We talk about tall poppy syndrome here. Mm. You know, people love nothing more than watching a successful person fall flat in their face and then say, why was that? Well, you're not allowed to be successful.
Yeah, I mean, listen, I'm Canadian. So we not only do we have the conservative nature of the British, but on top of that, we're all very polite and super risk adverse. Yeah. So, you know, being so close to the U.S., working with so many U.S. clients, part of what I love is their bullish nature. Part of what can be frustrating is their bullish nature, right? It's just like this expectation of I'm going to take on risk. I'm going to make it happen, fast, let's go. It's not really the environment here. I find that frustrating. I don't know about you, but the more conservative, in my experience, the more conservative your environment, and the more, you know, we can call it poppy syndrome again, that the highest poppy, the tallest dandelion will get cut off for standing out, just makes it all the easier to stand out. It makes it all the easier to be more of a risk taker, simply because the people that you're competing against aren't willing to do these little steps. And frankly, you know, it often doesn't take much to actually separate yourself from the rest. I've often said that, I don't know about you, but when I would sit down as a marketer with companies, I would say, okay, this is what you need to say to connect with your prospect or target audience. They want you to tell them that when you come in, you will do A, B, C, and you will make them feel this way. If you just say, we will do A, B, C, and we will make you feel this way, you will get their business. And they would go, but we can't make that claim. Well, why not? Well, we're not sure if we can deliver on ABC. We're not sure if we can make that promise. We're not sure about the operations. We're not sure about any of these things. And I'd say, listen, it's not marketing's job or brand's job or your salespeople's job to water down and dumb down the offer just because operations can't live up to it. It's your job to make these claims, to get the business, to make the sale. And then it's operations' job to live up to the promises and the expectations of that. And so when you're in a really conservative, when you're in a really slow, a really safe environment, making some of these claims or showing up in a certain way, will it turn some people off? Of course. But part of being courageous, part of standing out, part of being different, part of breaking the status quo that we all want to do as entrepreneurs isn't just to get the more money or the freedom of schedule, which tend to come later in life anyway. It's to do something that lights you up. It's to do something that you're proud of. And so we have to make those claims. We have to stand out. And it's easier to do that when you're surrounded by slow, safe people.
That leads us really neatly into your role as a brand strategist. And that's my background as well, the world of marketing, brand building, communication, advertising, PR, all of that good stuff. One of the questions I love to ask is, what is your definition of a brand?
It's such a great question, because I think we get caught up in definitions. Like my answer would typically be like, who cares? But for the purpose of this conversation, and I don't say that.
Well, the reason I care is that if we don't share a view on what a brand is, how on earth can we build it together? If we don't have a shared understanding of what we're trying to do.
Yeah. You
know, and let me just put a little bit more around that. You know, so sometimes I meet with people and say, a brand, well, that's my logo and my public face. That's the way my product looks. That's your view. Well, that then allows you to frame a context. Others talk about something much deeper and more philosophical. I'm interested, you know, a man that works in this area successfully, what does it mean to you?
Yeah, and the reason, that's a great point. The reason that I said that is because often though people will like, what's an entrepreneur? Am I an entrepreneur enough? I don't know. It's like, do I have a brand? Is my brand brandy enough or what have you? So ultimately, a brand, your brand, is how you proactively choose to show up and represent yourself and connect with those you need to connect with. So every single touch point that you have with the customer, again, people think logo, they think colors, they think photography, and that's all great. But ultimately, every single connection and touch point is represented by your brand. Here's a great story. I was at Tony Robbins' Unleash the Power Within with my friend Evan Carmichael. Now, people may know Evan Carmichael or not. He's a YouTuber, 3.5 million subscribers. We've known each other a long time. He's connected with Tony's group. So we're sitting in the front row. I'm not sitting in the front row because of me. We're sitting in the front row because of Evan. And as we're sitting in the front row, I'm looking to the left, I'm looking to the right, and there's Olympic snowboarders, and there's actors, and there's singers, and there's all these really fancy people. And I'm working with this guy who is an actor who's worked on Netflix shows. He's worked with Spike Lee. He's worked with all of these great people. And as I'm describing this very question, that your brand is really how you choose to show up for every single client interaction, that is your brand. That is what you're communicating. That's what you're putting out. He says, what do you mean? I said, well, like, here's a perfect example. Let's say that, that after you've made the sale, right? So you've gotten the lead, you've gone ahead and closed the lead, you've onboarded the client, you're sending them an invoice. How does that invoice make them feel? How does that interaction make them feel? What's the last thing they're thinking about you? That's your brand. And he goes, you know what, Mark? My business manager has been negotiating these things with these people, and I do not like the way that they're handling it. I don't think it's like true to my values. I don't think it's the way that I want to be perceived in the industry. I've been really worrying about this for a long time, but I think I've just realized I need to fire them. That's part of your brand, right? How you choose to show up. So in a brand, yes, it's your colors. Yes, it's your logo, but it's also the way that you speak, the words that you use. Do you feel corporate or not so, or more chaotic? Are you more technical or less technical? The types of clothes that you wear, the energy that you bring, the way you make people feel. Yes, it's the copy and it's the website and it's the podcast and it's all of the content, but it's every aspect of what you look like, what you say, and how you make people feel throughout the entire journey from a customer point of view.
All right. So, I mean, I think, for me, that makes a lot of sense, right? Because I think, but then that also kind of dovetails into culture, right? Mm-hmm. And I think what you're saying there is essentially, if you're thinking about your company, it's not only what your outward facing persona is, but it's also your inward facing, right? Because if you don't have the right people in the team that are actually building that all together, then you're not going to get anywhere. But I guess where I find it interesting is that, you know, people, when I've talked to people about branding in the past, right, they all say it's not just the logo and it's more about values and this, that, and the other. But it's very hard to pinpoint those values at the very beginning, because actually things change over time. So, you know, when you start a business, you'll say, okay, we're going to be the most luxurious, exotic, whatever it is that you want to be, right? But then halfway down the line, you realize actually no one wants to buy this except for Joe Blogs next door, who's only going to pay me £5 for it. So, you know, how does brand evolve over time? And is it a thing that, because I find that people are very scared to change things once they're set when it comes to branding, right? If they have a certain way of presenting themselves, they really get locked into it and they are unable to kind of change that, even if their business changes or the way that they change or the way they operate changes. So, I mean, from your experience, is it a fluid thing or is it something that is actually locked in and then you kind of have to then be that brand?
Yeah, if you're doing it right, it's totally fluid because you not only need to respond to the shifts in the zeitgeist or the culture, you have to respond to your competitors, you have to respond to the learning. You know, if you were to launch, let's say, an advertising campaign, let's say that you're coming to, you know, a company like us and you're saying, okay, I have £100,000 that I want to invest. I'm hoping to get $500,000 in return. And so you're going to work with us, let's say, and I mean, we don't do this anymore, but you'd work with us and we figure out, okay, what's the best ads? What's the best channel? You know, all the structure. And then a month in, we launch. cool, we're spending £10,000 this month. The following month, we would measure what worked and what didn't work, and we would make changes to respond. I mean, you just naturally would. You're a tech guy. If we're launching a new sprint and we go ahead and push out that sprint, and then we start working on the next sprint's client stories, they're stacking or building on the previous ones. But if stuff goes wrong, we don't go like, let's just bake that in right, to the system, right? Like, hey, there's patches we could release, but let's not go ahead and release those patches. So your brand is part of the operations. And when you really break it down, it's a bunch of technical components that can all be measured. And there are systematic ways to approach it. There are systematic ways to be able to understand your audiences better, or your target prospects, the sales process, velocity through the process, retention rate of customers. I mean, depending on your business model, you could be a service-based business, but you can still take SaaS style approaches to client retention and other things. So there are ways that we can and do engineer the brand building process, just like any other part of your operations. What people tend to get caught up in is a brand, unlike maybe other areas of your operations, can be very abstract in conversation. Some people approach it that way. It can be very visual, or can be more systematic and something that we measure, that we pace at, and we always touch on. Anytime that we're spending money on something month over month over month, most business owners would measure that to try and get the return. And then we try to make improvements upon that. Why wouldn't you approach your brand building process the same way?
Yeah, no, I agree. I think a lot of people get stuck on like Nike. Do you know what I mean? They see the logo and then that's pretty much it. And they're Apple.
And I think the issue there is that Nike has 40, 50 years to polish every facet of that. And when we're talking about early stage businesses, it's very malleable because we're learning as we go. So, you know, I couldn't agree more with what Mark is saying, that actually every single day things change and we learn all the time. Once we've done it a lot, we've probably got it in pretty good shape. But early on, we're reacting all the time. We're learning new things. And that has to impact on every part of the business. And anyone that is foolish enough to say, there is something in my business that is now so set it can never change, is unlikely to show any kind of success. Even, and I'm not going to try and rattle off some examples, even the most successful companies in the world, at some point, we're going, oh, that isn't really working the way we thought. Let's do it differently.
So, yeah. So basically, I guess what you guys are both saying is that don't get too hung up on branding on from day one, right? It should be something that you do have put some thought into it, but don't get too, I mean, don't really focus all your efforts on the branding piece. Get something, because I'm a kind of big believer of getting something out there. Just get something out there, see how it's reacted in the market. And then if it's, you know, refine it as the market tells you what it wants.
I might go a little bit further and say get something out there. Spend a reasonable and appropriate amount of time thinking about what it actually is you want to stand for and what you believe in. But then go forward with your eyes very wide open to make sure that your real life interactions are either confirming that it is only a hypothesis, or that you're then reflecting that actually this doesn't really resonate. You know, I think one of my points, Mark, interesting your view on this, you don't create a brand. Consumers create brands. They look at your business and what you do and draw conclusions. And that's really where the brand comes from. We don't sit in the exclusion of the market of our customers and design the brand.
Yeah, and I mean, that's a great point. So what you're touching on is that there's really, if we're talking about early startups, there's really two ways to approach it. The first is you just start, you learn as much as you can, and then later you come back and clean everything up when you realize you have no structure, you have no processes, you have no continuity, everything looks different, it's a mess. Most people start that way. 2-3 years in, they get some traction, and then they go, okay, now let's go ahead and do this. Or you approach it proactively. you define your values, your voice, who it is you want to be, what it is you stand for. You do the market research to understand the prospects, the target audience as much as possible, what they care about. And today we have, I mean, I've been doing this for 15 years. We have access to analytics. We have access to customer data. We have insights that we have never been able to have in the history of business. It's remarkable how much information we can actually collect on who these people are, what do they care about, which ways do they vote, what different types of activism are they into, their age, their household incomes, like the social channels that they follow, what they listen to. We can learn a remarkable amount about people. And then the competitive intel that we can collect in terms of what others are doing in the market, not so we can copy them, but so we in fact stand out and do something different from them. And so if you come at this foundationally, you know, who it is you need to be and what you are and what your customers, your target audience, your prospects care about most. And then the third ring in this circle of Venn diagrams is your competitors or the marketplace. You're at the very least launching with something that is grounded in substance. And then 3 months in, 6 months in, 12 months in, you can certainly change it because your brand is made up of this top level master brand, right? You know, like the overarching look, the overarching feel, the overarching sentiments that you're going to communicate or stories you're going to share. But then you're going to have like a product story or a service story. You're going to have an ad campaign, or you're going to launch a new initiative. You're going to go out with your salespeople and you're going to start having conversations with prospects and doing demos. And all these little pieces of information can shape that parent brand that can roll back up into what you're doing every 6 months or 9 months or a year. Because when you find that, oh, our salespeople are in fact having these types of conversations, and these are the common three objections that continually come up time and time again. Once we understand that, we can either bring that up to the parent brand proactively, we can choose not to, we can shift the conversation earlier on so that way those objections are no longer coming up later to smooth out the sales cycle. We could use those objections to differentiate ourselves from the competition. Like, this is a game. This is a game in data. This is a game in psychology. But studies have shown that most people think logo, colors, photos, they're super important. But making those kind of changes don't tend to move the needle on effectiveness of, say, an ad campaign. Changing the copy in the language, that tends to do 2-3 times more work. Changing the offer or the call to action tends to do 10-20 times more effectiveness. But connecting what you say in the marketplace to what your sales team is doing or saying, that tends to have like 100 to 200 times more effectiveness. Just connecting what you're putting out there with what the sales team needs to do, connecting marketing or communications or advertising to sales, is by far the most effective thing that you can do. So your brand is and should be a growing thing. And if you're the type of startup where you're kind of small, this is the greatest advantage you have, because you're the one having the conversations, right? You're the one who's learning all of these different things in real time. You don't have this huge departmental siloed issue that you have to try and overcome. So being small, being nimble, being quick, taking this stuff you're picking up and rolling it back into your brand is what allows you to create something really, really great, really, really quickly.
Our time is coming to an end, but there's something I particularly wanted to ask you about that was on your bio. You are not in the physical shape you're in now earlier in your life. Tell me about that story.
Yeah, so, you know, I started my company when I was 23. My first daughter was a week old. And I turned to my wife and I said, I'm going to quit my $45,000 a year job. She had no income. She was not on mat leave. I said, let's start this company. And, you know, I was never really athletic. I was never really focused on health in terms of diet or exercise or anything. But I can tell you there's one thing: when you work, you know, 50, 60, 70 hours consistently, when you never take a break, when you have constant anxiety year after year, and you're always out of your comfort zone, the last thing you're going to do, for me at least, was to like, hey, I'm going to take a few hours off every day and go work out. or I'm going to meal prep, or I'm going to focus on my diet. When you have four young kids, you have lots of excuses and everyone gives you a pass, right? I'm a business owner. I'm super busy. I've got four young kids at home. No one is going to call you out on it. But when year after year after year, you gain a few pounds here, a few pounds there, you move from, you know, a large shirt to an extra large, from an extra large to the next one. When you have to, when you move from a size, you know, 34 pelt when you're in your 20s to 36 to 38, suddenly I'm hitting size 40 pants. I realize, like, at 35 years old, so a few years ago, I realized, one, I don't feel good. I know I don't look good. I never felt attractive. I never felt confident. I hated the fact that at that point in my life, to tie up my shoes, I had to hold my breath because I couldn't, you know, breathe and tie up my shoes. I hated the fact that walking up a few flights of stairs left me winded. I hated the fact that if I had to put on a suit for, you know, a cousin's wedding or my grandmother's funeral, I had to go buy a suit each time because I was getting bigger and I didn't feel attractive and I was sweaty and I just hated all of that stuff. And we hit the point where, you know, I'm going into size 40 pants or whatever, because I'm 240 pounds. And my wife is going from a size 14 to a size 16 dress, which she's unhappy with. And we're just like, is this it? Like, ultimately that was the question in business, in life, in health. When you hit the point where you go like, is this it? I guess this is the rest of my life. If you stay there in that hopeless state, then you just kind of give up. And a lot of people do. And I did for many years. Or you can say, is this it? And you go, I don't want this to be the rest of my life. And so I started getting healthy and I started losing a bit of weight. But that trip to Tony Robbins that I took with Evan Carmichael, there's this exercise Tony takes you through where he wants you to imagine your future. And he wants you to imagine how bad it could be. And I thought, well, what if I don't live into my 60s, 70s and 80s the way that I thought? What if I'm not there for my kids? And then I had this really scary thought. What if I die at 45 of a heart attack from all the stress and the eating and whatnot? And what if I never get to meet my grandkids? And I thought of my firstborn grandson, a granddaughter. I've had four kids. So I thought of being in the hospital room, of turning to my daughter or my daughter-in-law as they hand me this baby wrapped in the blanket and me going, hey, whatever, Jimmy, whatever your name is, and looking into this baby's eyes and going, I'm your grandpa, or, you know, I'm here. And if I didn't change my health, not only would I not look better, not only would I feel better, those are all things that came that I didn't realize. The confidence, the feeling of attractiveness, the ability to go buy clothes that you look good in, the feeling comfortable taking your shirt off in public, like all that stuff I didn't even really think about. I just thought about, what if I don't meet my grandkids? What if it's not that I'm not there for me and my wife, not there for my kids because they're older? What if I never meet them?
And this is so story about fundamental motivation then. Why you do what you do.
Yeah, I mean, listen, when I'm on the treadmill, I don't do this so much anymore. You actually haven't even thought about this in a year, this meeting my grandkids thing. But what got me to start really making life changes is I'd be on the treadmill puffing away, barely being able to run. I'd be thinking, I'm gonna meet my grandkid. And I'm doing this for you.
I lost 70 odd pounds in my early 40s.
That's amazing.
No. I lost 70 pounds because I was diagnosed with cancer. And the treatment meant that I lost a third of my body weight in 5 months. So I didn't make an active choice to do that. But now, 15 years almost down the road from that, I hate the gym with a passion. There is nothing enjoyable, a minimal amount of enjoyment from doing exercise at a gym. But the benefit that I gain, and the way I look upon it now, is, oh, Father Time is here. And every time I walk out the gym, I give another punch in the nose and say, you're not getting me yet. I am just making sure, exactly what you described there, I don't know if I live to be 75, 80, whatever it happens to be. I want to be walking the dog. I want to be climbing the stairs. I want to be doing what I want to do, not accepting the scenario that I found myself in, which maybe brings us all the way back to the beginning of what we spoke about the courage of your convictions, the courage to go and do and make happen what you really want out of your life.
First of all, I mean, everything you just shared about not wanting to go to the gym, but feeling that you should, you must, and you're doing that for that greater cause. We can tie that back to business, though.
Yeah. You know,
For those who don't want to look at the financials because they're too scary. For those who say, "Oh, I'm not really good at it."
Life is a balance of pain and gain.
Yeah.
And as you mentioned right in the beginning, when you said there's a comfort zone, and actually, if you want to be great, go be great, but that won't be terribly comfortable most of the time because you'll have to do something. But the benefit of doing it when it works outweighs all the risk, anxiety, and stress that went into it. The reality is, it doesn't always work. And you,
yeah, true.
You know, that was your story in the beginning. You built something and watched it crumble. And I think the main thing I'm taking out of today really goes back to that first bit that we start off probably being foolish because we have no idea what we're letting ourselves in for. And then as we learn, we all learn as we go and we learn from our mistakes. And then the more that we do it, the more that we learn. And if you're risk averse, it's probably not going anywhere. But if you are courageous, then there's a chance to go out and make something special happen. And whatever that special is up to you. But have you any final thoughts or comments?
No, I mean, I think the one thing that we, I guess there's two things we all have in common, that we've all lost weight and that we all failed at some point in time, which is always a good one. But I think, I think one of the areas that most entrepreneurs underestimate is the amount of time they need to spend on themselves. And, you know, they need to be able to look in that mirror and be objective. Right. Because you could, you know, during that phase, I'm sure, Mark, during that period of time, you kind of let yourself off, because I know what it's like to start buying, you know, bigger clothes. And you get to a point in time where I just don't want to buy anymore. Like, why am I doing this? But there's lots of people who fool themselves into thinking, it's OK. It's OK. I can do it later. I can do it later. And I think what they do underestimate is once you're physically healthy, you're much more mentally healthy. And when you're mentally healthy, the business becomes easier to run, because a lot of the anxiety you mentioned before, there's a whole chunk of it gone away, because simply because you, as you said, you build up more confidence in yourself, you feel better, you have less of that, you know, personal issues. Right?
But let me be very, very transparent, very honest here. This is a journey throughout, because at my heaviest to my lightest, I lost 70 pounds, but right now I'm 20 pounds heavier than I was at my lightest. Right now, like last night, I still ate Oreo cookies when I'm supposed to be training for a Spartan race. I still think, because I do two workouts a day, like 5 days a week. I still go like, do I have to do this strength workout? I'm tired. Like I probably should be doing, and I'm using a lot of shoulds because there's this bar, there's this standard that I set for myself that I'm still falling short of. And I will tighten up and I'll go through 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 weeks and I'll make progress. And then I'll start to slow down. I'll let myself off and I'll start to fall back. And I would beat myself up for that. I would in the past say, this is the standard I need to hit. And anything short of the standard means that I'm failing in business, in earnings, in being a father, being a husband, in health or what have you. And what I've come to realize is the ebb and flow of this is the long game, right? This is the long game, and there are going to be gains and there are going to be losses, and there are going to be gains and there are going to be losses. And hopefully that we're stacking more gains than losses, so we come out ahead across the average. But the idea of being the entrepreneur who works nonstop and sees gain after gain and progress after progress without a single setback is a myth. And that's just as much true for our health. You know, you focusing on running and getting better at running, your strength is going to weaken. You want to lose some fat or some weight, you're going to cut, you're going to lose muscle. You want to gain muscle, you're going to gain fat. like there is always this balancing act. And I did not understand that until even just a few months ago. And so, I appreciate how much better I feel overall, but even today, I feel like I'm not where I was 6 months ago or 9 months ago. I feel like I've actually slid or backtracked.
I was going to say that I think what you've highlighted there is that, yes, you may have slid back, but that's all in an effort to make it sustainable, right? Because if you really set yourself, like you can't work 80 hours a week, right? You can't do that and train and then never sleep and, you know, wake up at stupid hours of the days every day and expect something not to suffer. And I think that's the key. It's with yourself and with business, it has to be sustainable. Actions that you do have to, you know, you may have ups and downs, but ultimately it's got to level out towards the end and then obviously grow towards in the future. But I think you've highlighted there that you don't give up. It's not, can't be all or nothing.
Yes. And I think that's a lovely point where we're going to have to wrap up for now. It's not about linear progression. It is a journey. There's ups and downs, and steps forward, steps back. But as long as you've got the ambition and the courage to keep going for what you really want, you may actually get there in the long term. Mark, thanks so much for joining us today all the way from Toronto. And I hope you enjoyed listening to that story. We'll see you next time on the podcast. Bye for now.
Many thanks for taking the time to listen to the podcast today. If you like what you hear, please leave a review or subscribe. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Google, Spotify, all the main podcasting sites. And if you'd like to learn more from us, you can contact Alan. He's alan@tbgp.co.uk. And you can find me at info@atomcto.com.